Conclusion. A century of war on the Palestinians. In 1917, Arthur James Balfour stated that in Palestine, the British government did not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. The great powers were committed to Zionism, he continued, and Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs, in future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. 100 years later, President Donald Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, saying, "We took Jerusalem off the table, so we don't have to talk about it anymore." Trump told Benjamin Netanyahu, "You won one point, and you'll give up some points later on in the negotiation, if it ever takes place." I don't know that it will ever take place. The center of the Palestinians' history, identity, culture, and worship was thus summarily disposed of without even the pretense of consulting their wishes. Throughout the intervening century, the great powers have repeatedly tried to act in spite of the Palestinians, ignoring them, talking for them or over their heads, or pretending that they did not exist. In the face of the heavy odds against them, however, the Palestinians have shown a stubborn capacity to resist these efforts to eliminate them politically and scatter them to the four winds. Indeed, more than 120 years after the first Zionist Congress in Basel, and over 70 years after the creation of Israel, the Palestinian people, represented on neither of these occasions, were no longer supposed to constitute any kind of national presence. In their place was meant to stand a Jewish state, uncontested by the indigenous society that it was meant to supplant. Yet, for all its might, its nuclear weapons, and its alliance with the United States, today the Jewish state is at least as contested globally as it was at any time in the past. The Palestinians' resistance, their persistence, and their challenge to Israel's ambitions are among the most striking phenomena of the current era. Over the decades, the United States has wavered, going back and forth between paying lip service to the existence of the Palestinians and trying to exclude them from the map of the Middle East. The provision for an Arab state in the 1947 partition resolution, albeit never implemented, Jimmy Carter's mention of a Palestinian homeland, and nominal support for a Palestinian state from the Clinton to the Obama administrations were artifacts of that lip service. There are many more instances of American exclusion and erasure. Lyndon Johnson's backing of UNSC 242, Kissinger's years of sidelining the PLO in the 1960s and 1970s, and covertly making proxy war on it, the 1978 Camp David Accords, the Reagan administration's green light for the 1982 war in Lebanon, the lack of will of U.S. presidents from Johnson to Obama to stop Israeli seizure and settlement of Palestinian land. Regardless of its wavering, the United States, the great imperial power of the age, together with Great Britain before it, extended full backing to the Zionist movement and the State of Israel. But they have been trying to do the impossible, impose a colonial reality on Palestine in a post-colonial age. Iqbal Ahmad summed it up. August 1947 marked the beginning of decolonization, when British rule in India ended. It was in those days of hope and fulfillment that the colonization of Palestine occurred. Thus, at the dawn of decolonization, we were returned to the earliest, most intense form of colonial menace, exclusivist settler colonialism. In other circumstances, or in another era, replacing the indigenous population might have been feasible, especially in light of the long-standing and deep religious link felt by Jews to the land in question. If this were the 18th or 19th century, if the Palestinians were as few as the Zionist settlers, or as fully decimated as the native peoples of Australasia and North America. The longevity of the Palestinians' resistance to their dispossession, however, indicates that the Zionist movement, in the words of the late historian Tony Judt, arrived too late, as it imported a characteristically late 19th century separatist project into a world that has moved on. With the establishment of Israel, Zionism did succeed in fashioning a potent national movement and a thriving new people in Palestine. But it could not fully supplant the country's original population, which is what would have been necessary for the ultimate triumph of Zionism. Settler colonial confrontations with indigenous peoples have only ended in one of three ways: with the elimination or full subjugation of the native population, as in North America; with the defeat and expulsion of the colonizer, as in Algeria, which is extremely rare; or with the abandonment of colonial supremacy in the context of compromise and reconciliation, as in South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Ireland. There is still the possibility that Israel could attempt to reprise the expulsions of 1948 and 1967 and rid itself of some or all of the Palestinians who tenaciously remain in their homeland. Forcible transfers of population on a sectarian and ethnic basis have taken place in neighboring Iraq since its invasion by the United States, and in Syria following its collapse into war and chaos. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reported in 2017 that a record 68 million persons and refugees were displaced the world over. Against this horrific regional and global background, which elicits scarce concern internationally, there might seem to be little to restrain Israel from such an action. But the ferocious fight that Palestinians would wage against their removal, the intense international attention to the conflict, and the growing currency of the Palestinian narrative all mitigate against such a prospect. Given the clarity of what is involved in ethnic cleansing in a colonial situation, rather than in circumstances of a confusing civil-cum-proxy war interlaced with extensive foreign intervention, as in Syria and Iraq, a new wave of expulsions would probably not unfold as smoothly for Israel as in the past. Even if undertaken under cover of a major regional war, such a move would have the potential to cause fatal damage to the West's support for Israel, on which it relies. Nonetheless, there are growing fears that expulsion has become more possible in the past few years than at any time since 1948, with religious nationalists and settlers dominating successive Israeli governments, explicit plans for annexations in the West Bank, and leading Israeli parliamentarians calling for the removal of some or all of the Palestinian population. Punitive Israeli policies are currently directed at forcing as many Palestinians as possible out of the country, while also evicting some within the West Bank and the Negev inside Israel from their homes and villages via home demolition, fake property sales, rezoning, and myriad other schemes. It is only a step from these tried and true demographic engineering tactics to a repeat of the full-blown ethnic cleansing of 1948 and 1967. Still, the odds so far seem against Israelis taking such a step. If elimination of the native population is not a likely outcome in Palestine, then what of dismantling the supremacy of the colonizer in order to make possible a true reconciliation? The advantage that Israel has enjoyed in continuing its project rests on the fact that the basically colonial nature of the encounter in Palestine has not been visible to most Americans and many Europeans. Israel appears to them to be a normal, natural nation-state like any other, faced by the irrational hostility of intransigent and often anti-Semitic Muslims, which is how Palestinians, even the Christians among them, are seen by many. The propagation of this image is one of the greatest achievements of Zionism and is vital to its survival. As Edward Said put it, Zionism triumphed in part because it won the political battle for Palestine in the international world in which ideas, representation, rhetoric, and images were at issue. This is still largely true today. Dismantling this fallacy and making the true nature of the conflict evident is a necessary step if Palestinians and Israelis are to transition to a post-colonial future, in which one people does not use external support to oppress and supplant the other. Recent polls have revealed the shifts that have begun to take place among some segments of American public opinion. While encouraging to advocates of Palestinian freedom, they do not reflect the stance of most Americans. nor are they necessarily based on a sound understanding of the colonial dynamic at work in the conflict. Moreover, public opinion can shift again. Events on the ground in Palestine have recently tilted the scales of sympathy slightly in favor of the Palestinians, but other events could cause them to tilt in the opposite direction, as happened during the Second Intifada. Amply funded efforts have been launched to achieve just such a reversal, in particular by smearing critics of Israel as anti-Semites, while counter-efforts to strengthen this positive trend are puny by comparison. The experience of the past few decades shows that three approaches have been effective in expanding the way in which the reality in Palestine is understood. The first rests on the fertile comparison of the case of Palestine to other colonial settler experiences, whether that of Native Americans, or South Africans, or the Irish. The second, related to the first, involves focusing on the gross imbalance of power between Israel and the Palestinians, a characteristic of all colonial encounters. The third, and perhaps most important, is to foreground the issue of inequality. Establishing the colonial nature of the conflict has proven exceedingly hard given the biblical dimension of Zionism, which casts the new arrivals as indigenous and as the historic proprietors of the land they colonized. In this light, the original population of Palestine appears extraneous to the post-Holocaust resurgence of a Jewish nation-state with its roots in the kingdom of David and Solomon. They are no more than undesirable interlopers in this uplifting scenario. Challenging this epic myth is especially difficult in the United States, which is steeped in an evangelical Protestantism that makes it particularly susceptible to such an evocative Bible-based appeal, and which also prides itself on its colonial past. The word colonial has a valence in the United States that is deeply different from its associations in the former European imperial metropoles and the countries that were once part of their empires. Similarly, the terms settler and pioneer have positive connotations in American history, arising from the heroic tale of the conquest of the West at the expense of its indigenous population, as projected in movies, literature, and television. Indeed, there are striking parallels between these portrayals of the resistance of Native Americans to their dispossession and that of the Palestinians. Both groups are cast as backward and uncivilized, a violent, murderous, and irrational obstacle to progress and modernity. While many Americans have begun to contest this strand of their national narrative, Israeli society and its supporters still celebrate, indeed depend on, its foundational version. Moreover, comparisons between Palestine and the Native American or African American experiences are fraught, because the United States has yet to fully acknowledge these dark chapters of its past, or to address their toxic effects in the present. There is still a long way to go to change Americans' consciousness of their nation's history, let alone that of Palestine and Israel, in which the United States has played such a supportive role. The second track for changing existing perceptions of the conflict, highlighting the great imbalance between the Palestinians and the powers arrayed against them, involves showing that the Zionist movement was almost always on the offensive in its effort to achieve mastery over an Arab land. Presenting this reality otherwise has been central to the discursive advantage achieved by Zionism, in which Israel is David to the Arab/Muslim Goliath. A more recent fiction casts the conflict as one of two peoples, or even two states, in an equal fight, sometimes framed as right versus right. Even then, the accepted version is that Israel has constantly wished for peace, only to be rebuffed by the Palestinians. There is no partner for peace, as the phrase goes, leaving Israelis, the victims, to defend themselves against unjustifiable terrorism and rocket fire. In reality, the Zionist movement and then the State of Israel always had the big battalions on their side. Whether this was the British Army before 1939, U.S. and Soviet support in 1947-48, France and Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, or the situation from the 1970s until today, where besides receiving unlimited U.S. support, Israel's armed might dwarfs that of the Palestinians, and indeed that of all the Arabs put together. It is the issue of inequality that is most promising for expanding the understanding of the reality in Palestine. It is also the most important, since inequality was essential to the creation of a Jewish state in an overwhelmingly Arab land, and is vital to maintaining that state's dominance. Inequality is so crucial not only because it is anathema to the egalitarian, democratic societies that the Zionist project has primarily relied on for its support, but because equality of rights is key to a just, lasting resolution of the entire problem. Within Israel, certain important rights are reserved exclusively for Jewish citizens and denied to the 20% of citizens who are Palestinian. Of course, the 5 million Palestinians living under an Israeli military regime in the occupied territories have no rights at all, while the 500,000-plus Israeli colonists there enjoy full rights. This systemic ethnic discrimination was always a central facet of Zionism, which by definition aimed to create a Jewish society and polity with exclusive national rights in a land with an Arab majority. Even as Israel's 1948 Declaration of Independence proclaimed complete equality of social and political rights to all its inhabitants, irrespective of religion, race, or sex, dozens of crucial laws based on inequality of rights were implemented in the ensuing years. These severely restricted or totally banned Arab access to land and to residency in all Jewish communities, formalized the seizure of the private and collective waqf property of non-Jews, prevented most indigenous Palestinians who were made into refugees from returning to their homes while giving citizenship rights to Jewish immigrants, and limited access to many other benefits. This core problem is even more stark today, with a total Arab population in Palestine and Israel from the Jordan River to the sea that is equal to, or perhaps slightly larger than, the Jewish population. That inequality is the central moral question posed by Zionism, and that it goes to the root of the legitimacy of the entire enterprise is a view that is shared by some distinguished Israelis. Imagining scholars looking back 100 years from now, historian Zev Sternhell asked, "When exactly did the Israelis understand that their cruelty towards the non-Jews and their grip in the occupied territories, their determination to break the Palestinians' hopes for independence, or their refusal to offer asylum to African refugees began to undermine the moral legitimacy of their national existence?" For decades, Zionists insisted, often referring to the state's Declaration of Independence, that Israel could be and was both Jewish and democratic. As the contradictions inherent in this formulation grew ever more apparent, some Israeli leaders admitted, indeed even declared it with pride, that if they were forced to choose, the Jewish aspect would take precedence. In July 2018, the Knesset codified that choice in a constitutional law, adopting the Basic Law on the Jewish Nation-State, which institutionalized statutory inequality among Israeli citizens by arrogating the right of national self-determination exclusively to the Jewish people, downgrading the status of Arabic and declaring Jewish settlement a national value with precedence over other needs. Former Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, one of the more forthright advocates of Jewish supremacy and a sponsor of the law, had made the case bluntly a few months before the legislation came to a vote. "There are places where the character of the State of Israel as a Jewish state must be maintained, and this sometimes comes at the expense of equality," she added. "Israel isn't a state of all its nations, that is, equal rights to all citizens, but not equal national rights." Where this ideology leads was summarized in the equally blunt words of Likud Knesset member Miki Zohar. "The Palestinian," he said, "does not have the right of self-determination because he is not the proprietor of the land. I want him as a resident because of my honesty, as he was born here, he lives here, and I would never tell him to leave. I regret to say it, but they suffer from one major deficit. They were not born Jews." This connection between an exclusive right to land and peoplehood is central to a specific type of blood and soil, Central European nationalism, which is the ground from which Zionism sprang. Commenting on an early draft of the Jewish nation-state law, Sternhell, whose area of expertise is European fascism, noted that the constitutional ideas behind the legislation are consonant with those of Charles Maurras, the French anti-Semite and neo-fascist of the 1930s, or of modern-day Polish and Hungarian nationalists and the hardest-line European chauvinists. However, he added, they are entirely at odds with the liberal ideas of the French and American revolutions. By embracing its illiberal and discriminatory essence, modern Zionism is increasingly in contradiction with the ideals, particularly that of equality, on which Western democracies are based. For the United States, Canada, Great Britain, France, and Germany, which cherish these values, even if they are honored only in the breach, and are currently threatened by potent, illiberal, populist, and authoritarian right-wing trends, this should be a serious matter, especially given that Israel is still dependent on the support of these Western countries. Finally, uprooting the systemic inequality inherent in Zionism is crucial to creating a better future for both peoples, Palestinians and Israelis. Any formula advanced as a resolution of the conflict will necessarily and inevitably fail if it is not squarely based on the principle of equality. Absolute equality of human, personal, civil, political, and national rights must be enshrined in whatever future scheme is ultimately accepted by the two societies. This is a high-sounding recommendation, but nothing else will address the core of the problem, nor will it be sustainable and lasting. This leaves the thorny issue of how to wean Israelis from their attachment to inequality, which is often coded as and justified by a need for security. This perceived need is to a large extent rooted in a real history of insecurity and persecution, but in response to this past trauma, generations have now been brought up on a reflexive dogma of aggressive nationalism whose tenacious hold will be hard to break. Thus, the Jewish citizens of a regional superpower that cows its neighbors and has bombed the capitals of seven of them with impunity suffer from a deep insecurity rooted in part in this history and perhaps in part from an unspoken concern that the carefully constructed and justified colonial reality they live in might suddenly unravel. The syndrome that drives this imperative to dominate and discriminate can probably only be addressed by those within Israeli society, or close to it, who understand the grim direction of the country's current course, and who can challenge the distortions of history, ethics, and Judaism that this ideology constitutes. Doing so is surely the primary and the most urgent task of Israelis and their supporters who wish to change the dynamic of injustice and inequality. Palestinians, too, need weaning from a pernicious delusion, rooted in the colonial nature of their encounter with Zionism and in its denial of Palestinian peoplehood, that Jewish Israelis are not a real people, and that they do not have national rights. While it is true that Zionism has transmuted the Jewish religion and the historic peoplehood of the Jews into something quite different, a modern nationalism, this does not erase the fact that Israeli Jews today consider themselves a people with a sense of national belonging in Palestine, what they think of as the land of Israel, no matter how this transmutation came about. Palestinians, too, today consider themselves a people with national links to what is indeed their ancestral homeland, for reasons that are as arbitrary and as conjunctural as those that led to Zionism, as arbitrary as any of the reasons that led to the emergence of scores of modern national movements. Such a conclusion about the constructed nature of all national entities, enraging to apostles of nationalism, is self-evident to those who have studied its genesis in myriad different circumstances. The irony is that, like all peoples, Palestinians assume that their nationalism is pure and historically rooted, while denying the same of Israeli Jews. There is, of course, a difference between the two. Most Palestinians are descended from people who have lived in what they naturally see as their country for a very long time, for many centuries, if not millennia. Most Israeli Jews came from Europe and the Arab countries relatively recently as part of a colonial process sanctioned and brokered by the great powers. The former are indigenous, the latter settlers or descendants of settlers, although many have been there for generations now and have a deeply felt and ancient religious connection to the country, albeit one quite different from the ancient rootedness in the country of the indigenous Palestinians. Because this is a colonial conflict, this difference matters enormously. However, no one today would deny that fully developed national entities exist in settler states like the United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, despite their origins and colonial wars of extermination. Moreover, to those intoxicated by nationalism, such distinctions between settlers and indigenous peoples do not matter. As the anthropologist Ernest Gellner put it, nations as a natural, God-given way of classifying men as an inherent political destiny are a myth. Nationalism, which sometimes takes pre-existing cultures and turns them into nations, sometimes invents them, and often obliterates pre-existing cultures. That is a reality. While the fundamentally colonial nature of the Palestinian-Israeli encounter must be acknowledged, there are now two peoples in Palestine, irrespective of how they came into being, and the conflict between them cannot be resolved as long as the national existence of each is denied by the other. Their mutual acceptance can only be based on complete equality of rights, including national rights, notwithstanding the crucial historical differences between the two. There is no other possible sustainable solution, barring the unthinkable notion of one people's extermination or expulsion by the other. Overcoming the resistance of those who benefit from the status quo in order to ensure equal rights for all in this small country between the Jordan River and the sea, this is a test of the political ingenuity of all concerned. Reducing the extensive, sustained external support for the discriminatory and deeply unequal status quo would certainly smooth the path ahead. However, the war on Palestine passed the 100-year mark with the Palestinians confronting circumstances more daunting than perhaps at any time since 1917. With his election, Donald Trump began pursuit of what he called the deal of the century, purportedly aimed at a conclusive resolution of the conflict. Closing the deal has so far involved dispensing with decades of bedrock U.S. policies, outsourcing strategic planning to Israel, and pouring contempt on the Palestinians. Inauspiciously, Trump's ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, his bankruptcy lawyer and a longtime financial supporter of the Jewish settler movement, spoke of an alleged occupation and demanded that the State Department stop using the term. In one interview, he declared that Israel has the right to annex some, but unlikely all, of the West Bank. Jason Greenblatt, for over 2 years envoy for Israel-Palestine negotiations, previously Trump's real estate lawyer, and also a donor to Israeli right-wing causes, stated that West Bank settlements are not an obstacle to peace, rejected use of the term occupation in a meeting with EU envoys, and endorsed Friedman's views regarding annexation. The new administration quickly trumpeted an outside-in approach in which three of the Sunni Arab Gulf monarchies, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and Bahrain, often falsely described as representing Sunni Arabs, were brought into a de facto alliance with Israel to stand together against Iran. The byproduct of this configuration was that these and other Arab regimes allied to the U.S. were encouraged to bully the Palestinians to accept maximalist Israeli positions that would be, and appeared intended to be, fatal to their cause. This initiative was coordinated closely with these regimes via the mediation of Presidential Envoy Extraordinaire Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, also a real estate mogul, and an ardent extreme Zionist, whose family had also donated to Jewish settlements. In collusion with their Gulf partners at a June 2019 conference in Bahrain and in other venues, Kushner, Greenblatt, and Friedman publicly pushed what was essentially an economic development initiative for the West Bank and Gaza Strip, meant to operate under existing conditions of virtually complete Israeli control. Kushner cast doubt on the feasibility of independent Palestinian self-rule, saying, "We'll have to see." He drew on the classic colonialist lexicon to add, "The hope is that they, over time, can become capable of governing." All the Palestinians deserved, in Kushner's view, was the opportunity to live a better life, the opportunity to pay their mortgage. With their essentially economic solution, this troika displayed remarkable ignorance of a solid expert consensus that the Palestinian economy has been strangled primarily by the systematic interference of the Israeli military occupation that their plan meant to keep in place. The Trump administration exacerbated this economic stranglehold by cutting off U.S. aid to the PA and to the UNRWA. The U.S. also continued to support Israel's blockade of Gaza, aided by Egypt, with its disastrous effects on 1.8 million people. The crucial political aspect of Trump's deal of the century was reportedly contained in the outlines of an American-Israeli proposal that the PA was pressured to accept. This purportedly involved creating a non-contiguous, non-sovereign entity without removal of any of the existing illegal Israeli settlements, which would be recognized, legalized, and annexed to Israel. This entity would remain under full Israeli security control, for which the Palestinians would reportedly have to pay, and therefore be a state in name only. It would exclude sovereignty or control over Jerusalem and be located in the Gaza Strip, and the scores of disparate fragments totaling under 40% of the West Bank that constitute areas A and B, with some parts of C perhaps to be included, but only subject to further negotiations. Integrally linked to such an approach was Trump's December 2017 recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital and the subsequent relocation of the U.S. embassy there. This move marked a revolutionary departure from over 70 years of U.S. policy, going back to UNGA 181, whereby the status of the Holy City was to remain undetermined pending a final resolution of the Palestine question, to be mutually agreed by both sides. This affront was then followed by Trump's proclamation recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the annexed Golan Heights, another radical U.S. policy shift. With these two pronouncements, the administration unilaterally took issues, one of which, that of Jerusalem, Israel is treaty-bound to negotiate with the Palestinians, off the table. As well as reversing decades of American policy, the Trump ensemble spurned an entire body of international law and consensus, UN Security Council decisions, world opinion, and, of course, Palestinian rights. Trump accepted fully Israel's stand on the vital issue of Jerusalem and did so without any quid pro quo from Israel and without any acknowledgement of Palestinian demands for recognition of the city as the capital of Palestine. Equally important, by implication, Trump endorsed Israel's expansive definition of a unified Jerusalem, including the extensive Arab areas in and around the city appropriated by Israel since 1967. Although the administration stated that actual borders were still to be negotiated, its proclamation meant, in effect, that there was nothing left to negotiate. Through these and other actions, the White House implicitly confirmed the outlines of the American-Israeli proposal. It explicitly avoided endorsing a two-state solution. It closed the Palestinian mission in Washington, D.C., and the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem that had served as an informal embassy to the Palestinians. It claimed that, contrary to the status of all other refugees since World War II, the descendants of Palestinians declared refugees in 1948. Are not themselves refugees. Finally, by endorsing Israel's annexation of Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, Trump cleared the way for the annexation of whatever parts of the occupied West Bank Israel should choose to swallow up. In exchange for these drastic derogations of Palestinian rights, the Palestinians were to be offered money, collected from the Gulf monarchies. The offer was formalized at the June 2019 conference in Bahrain that the PA refused to attend. Kushner's proposal to buy off Palestinian opposition to a plan that obviated a negotiated political settlement was in fact no more than a reheated version of similar plans for economic peace, in lieu of rights peddled by Israeli leaders from Shimon Peres to Netanyahu. For Netanyahu and ultranationalist supporters of extremist settlers, an economic sweetener for the bitter pill the Palestinians were meant to swallow had become an essential plank in their explicitly annexationist approach. Indeed, what was most striking about this White House's Middle East policy was that it had been effectively outsourced to Netanyahu and his allies in Israel and the United States. Its initiatives seem to have come prepackaged from the Israeli right's storehouse of ideas, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing the annexation of the Golan, airily dispensing with the Palestinian refugee issue, trying to liquidate UNRWA, and withdrawing from the Obama-era nuclear agreement with Iran. Only a few items remained on Netanyahu's wish list: annexation of much of the West Bank, formal American rejection of sovereign Palestinian statehood, the creation of a toothless Palestinian Quisling leadership, the entire package meant to coerce the Palestinians to accept that they are a defeated people. None of this was entirely new, given past American practice. But Trump's people abandoned even the shabby old pretense at impartiality. With this plan, the United States ceased to be Israel's lawyer, becoming instead the mouthpiece of the most extreme government in Israel's history, proposing to negotiate directly with the Palestinians on Israel's behalf, with the welcome assistance of its closest Arab allies. Perhaps the White House was up to something else, generating draft proposals that were so offensively pro-Israel as to be unacceptable to even the most compliant Palestinians. With this tactic, the Israeli government could paint the Palestinians as rejectionist and continue to avoid negotiations while maintaining the status quo of creeping annexation, expanding colonization, and legal discrimination. In either case, the outcome would be the same. The Palestinians were put on notice that the prospect of an independent future in their homeland was closed off, and that the Israeli colonial endeavor had a free hand to shape Palestine as it wished. This is a conclusion that most of the world rejects, and it will surely be met with resistance, both locally and globally. It is also at odds with every principle of freedom, justice, and equality that the United States is supposed to stand for. A resolution imposed strictly on harsh Israeli terms will inevitably bring more conflict and insecurity for all concerned. For the Palestinians, though, it also presents opportunities. The existing strategies of both of the leading Palestinian political factions, Fatah and Hamas, have come to nothing, evidenced by the acceleration of Israeli control over all of Palestine. Neither dependence on U.S. mediation and fruitless negotiations as part of the sole resort to feeble diplomacy of the Abbas era, nor a nominal strategy of armed resistance, has advanced Palestinian national aims over the past few decades. Nor is there much for the Palestinians to expect from Arab regimes like those of Egypt and Jordan, which today have no shame in signing massive gas deals with Israel, or Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which have purchased Israeli weapons and security systems through American cutouts that only thinly disguise their origins. These realizations necessitate a careful reassessment by the Palestinians of their methods, whether their national goals are defined as an end to occupation and reversing the colonization of Palestinian land, establishing a Palestinian state in the remaining 22% of mandatory Palestine with Arab East Jerusalem as its capital, the return to their ancestral homeland of that half of the Palestinian people who are currently living in exile, or creating a democratic, sovereign, binational state in all of Palestine with equal rights for all, or some combination or permutation of these options. As the weaker party in the conflict, the Palestinian side cannot afford to remain divided. But before unity can be achieved, a redefinition of objectives must take place on the basis of a new national consensus. It is a searing indictment of both Fatah and Hamas that in recent decades, civil society initiatives such as the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, and student activism have done more to further the Palestine cause than anything either of these two main factions has undertaken. A reconciliation would at least repair some of the damage caused by their split, but reconciliation between two ideologically bankrupt political movements, important though it would be, cannot provide the dynamic new strategy needed to dislodge the Palestinian cause from its current state of stagnation and retreat. One key change that is needed involves acknowledging that the diplomatic strategy adopted by the PLO since the 1980s was fatally flawed. The United States is not and cannot be a mediator, a broker, or a neutral party. It has long opposed Palestinian national aspirations and has formally committed itself to support the Israeli government's positions on Palestine. The Palestinian national movement must recognize the true nature of the American stance and undertake dedicated grassroots political and informational work to make its case inside the United States, as the Zionist movement has done for over a century. This task will not necessarily take generations, given the significant shifts that have already occurred in key sectors of public opinion. There is a great deal to build on. Yet the bifurcated Palestinian leadership today appears to have no better understanding of the workings of American society and politics than its predecessors had. It does not have any idea of how to engage with American public opinion and has made no serious attempt to do so. This ignorance of the complex nature of the U.S. political system has prevented the fashioning of a sustained program to reach potentially sympathetic elements of civil society. By contrast, in spite of the dominant position Israel and its supporters enjoy in the United States, they continue to expend lavish resources to advance their cause in the public arena. Although the effort to support Palestinian rights is poorly funded and has been comprised only of initiatives by elements of civil society, it has achieved remarkable success in such spheres as the arts, notably cinema and theater, the legal realm, where defenders of free speech and the First Amendment have become vital allies against sustained attacks on supporters of BDS, sectors of academia, notably Middle East and American studies, some unions and churches, and key parts of the base of the Democratic Party. Similar work needs to be directed at Europe, Russia, India, China, Brazil, and non-aligned states. Israel has made progress in recent years in cultivating the elites and public opinion in these countries, while many of them, especially China and India, are becoming more active in the Middle East. Although most Arab states are controlled by undemocratic regimes, subservient to the United States and desirous of Israeli approval, Arab public opinion remains acutely sensitive to the appeal of Palestine. Thus, in 2016, 75% of respondents in 12 Arab countries considered the Palestine cause one of concern to all Arabs, and 86% disapproved of Arab recognition of Israel because of its policies directed against Palestine. The Palestinians need to resurrect the PLO's former strategy of appealing over the heads of unresponsive regimes to sympathetic Arab public opinion. Most important is that should entering negotiations based on a Palestinian consensus become feasible, any future diplomacy must reject the Oslo interim formula and proceed on an entirely different basis. An intensive global public relations and diplomatic campaign must be aimed at demanding international sponsorship and rejecting exclusive U.S. control of the process, a demand that has already been feebly made by the PA. Beyond this, for the purpose of negotiations, the Palestinians ought to treat the United States as an extension of Israel. As a superpower, it would necessarily be represented at any talks, but it should be considered as an adversarial party, even seated with Israel on the opposite side of the table, which would represent its real position, at least since 1967. New negotiations would need to reopen all the crucial issues created by the 1948 war that were closed in Israel's favor in 1967 by UNSC 242. The 1947 UNGA 181 partition borders and its corpus separatum proposal for Jerusalem, the return and compensation of refugees, and the political, national, and civil rights of Palestinians inside Israel. Such talks should stress complete equality of treatment of both peoples and be based on The Hague and Fourth Geneva Conventions, the United Nations Charter with its stress on national self-determination, and all relevant UN Security Council and General Assembly resolutions, not just those cherry-picked by the United States to favor Israel. The current administration in Washington and the Israeli government would, of course, never accept such terms, and so these would, for the moment, constitute impossible preconditions for negotiations. That is precisely the point. They are meant to move the goalposts away from formulas devised as advantageous to Israel. Continuing to negotiate on the existing deeply flawed basis can only entrench a status quo that is leading toward the final absorption of Palestine into the greater land of Israel. If a serious and sustained Palestinian diplomatic and public relations effort campaigned for such new terms, aimed at reaching a just and equitable peace, many countries would be amenable to considering them. They might even be willing to challenge the half-century-long U.S. monopoly on peacemaking, a monopoly that has been crucial in preventing peace in Palestine. A forgotten but essential element of the Palestinian political agenda is work inside Israel, specifically convincing Israelis that there is an alternative to the ongoing oppression of the Palestinians. This is a long-term process that cannot be dismissed as a form of normalizing relations with Israel. Neither the Algerians nor the Vietnamese short-sightedly denied themselves the opportunity to convince public opinion in the home country of their oppressor of the justice of their cause, efforts that contributed measurably to their victory. Nor should the Palestinians. The Palestinian people, whose resistance to colonialism has involved an uphill battle, should not expect quick results. They have shown unusual patience, perseverance, and steadfastness in defending their rights, which is the main reason that their cause is still alive. It is now essential for all the elements in Palestinian society to adopt a considered, long-term strategy, which means rethinking much that has been done in the past, understanding how other liberation movements succeeded in altering an unfavorable balance of forces, and cultivating all possible allies in their struggle. Given an Arab world that is in a state of disarray greater than at any time since the end of World War I, and a Palestinian national movement that appears to be without a compass, it might seem that this is an opportune moment for Israel and the United States to collude with their autocratic Arab partners to bury the Palestine question, dispose of the Palestinians, and declare victory. It is not likely to be quite so simple. There is the not inconsiderable matter of the Arab public, which can be fooled some of the time, but not all of the time, and that emerges with Palestinian flags flying whenever democratic currents rise against autocracy, as in Cairo in 2011, and in Algiers in the spring of 2019. Israel's regional hegemony depends in very large measure on the maintenance in power of undemocratic Arab regimes that will suppress such sentiment. However distant it may seem today, real democracy in the Arab world would be a grave threat to Israel's regional dominance and freedom of action. Just as important, there is also the popular resistance that the Palestinians can be expected to continue to mount, whatever the shabby deal to which their discredited leaders may mistakenly assent. Though Israel is the nuclear regional hegemon, its domination is not uncontested in the Middle East, nor is the legitimacy of the undemocratic Arab regimes which are increasingly becoming its clients. Finally, the United States, for all its power, has played a secondary role, sometimes no role at all, in the crises in Syria, Yemen, Libya, and elsewhere in the region. It will not necessarily maintain the near monopoly over the Palestine question, and indeed over the entire Middle East, that it has enjoyed for so long. Configurations of global power have been changing. Based on their growing energy needs, China and India will have more to say about the Middle East in the 21st century than they did in the previous one. Being closer to the Middle East, Europe and Russia have been more affected than the United States by the instability there and can be expected to play larger roles. The United States will most likely not continue to have the free hand that Britain once did. Perhaps such changes will allow Palestinians, together with Israelis and others worldwide who wish for peace and stability with justice in Palestine, to craft a different trajectory than that of oppression of one people by another. Only such a path based on equality and justice is capable of concluding the 100 years' war on Palestine with a lasting peace, one that brings with it the liberation that the Palestinian people deserve. This is Fajr Al-Kaisi. We hope you've enjoyed the 100 Years' War on Palestine, a history of settler colonialism and resistance, 1917 to 2017. A Macmillan audio production from Metropolitan Books. This title was produced by Katie Robitsky. Text copyright 2019 by Rashid Khaldi. Production copyright 2019 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.